Hi folks, welcome to episode 27 of the Epochs of the Load Seater. This week I'm joined by Bo, and we are going to be talking about the Nika riots. One of the most infamous events of Justinian's reign, really, aren't they? Because of how absolutely awful they must have been on the day.
Yeah, I mean, riots doesn't even seem like the right word for it.
Well,
it's a full insurrection.
Yeah.
Or some sort of internal rebellion. Riots doesn't seem strong enough.
No, I completely agree. I mean, when you're reading about it, it's like, wow, they're downplaying this. And it's huge as well. Something like 30,000, 40,000 people involved in it. And so, Constantinople's a big city, but that's a large number of people. And it's all against the backdrop of all this political instability and various other, crises going on around the world. In Spain and Persia, Justinian's trying to, negotiate peace treaties or something like this. And his reign's becoming, unstable, to say the least. And it's mad. But like I was saying before we started, it's been literally about a decade since I read about this. So you're gonna have to walk me through it. So what was the circumstance that led up to it?
Okay, well, I mean, we could just talk about that for quite a while. But so put it in its context, or put Justinian in his context. This happens in the year 532 AD, and it's in Constantinople, modern day Istanbul, and it's the Eastern Roman Empire. A lot of people probably know that
the West having fallen about 100 years ago.
Well, so that's the thing, yeah. So Justinian's reign is known as sort of quite a tumultuous one. It's very long. It's sort of just shy of 40 years. And in that time, one of the most famous things, perhaps even more famous than the Nika riots, is that he reconquered the West. Mm. The Western Roman Empire, Italy, and all that sort of thing, had fallen to all sorts of different Germanic barbaric peoples.
Because, the fall of the Western Roman Empire had nothing to do with immigration. Mary Beard, moving on.
And so this happens, the Nika riots happen quite early in his reign. He's only been emperor for like 4 or 5 years by that point. We can just get into it. Mm-hmm. I suppose one of the first things to say, might be worth saying quite early on in this epoch, is the historiography of it. There's a guy called Procopius, who was a very senior minister, for want of a better word, in the Byzantine court, and he wrote two different histories, the sort of a formal official history that he was supposed to write, which is paints Justinian as sort of a shining paragon of sort of kingly virtue.
Did nothing wrong.
Imperial virtue, he did nothing wrong. And the other one, the secret history, which he apparently never intended to publish, but was found in his papers after his death. It's sort of more honest, or historians think it's more sort of true and honest. And he paints Justinian as a tyrant, as a really dirty, horrible piece of work.
See, that's the absolute best way to do it, right? The official history that Justinian will, lavish praise on you and gold on you, and then write the secret one that you just leave with your possessions to be found after your death. So what are you going to do, punish me? Too late for that. The world knows you're an evil tyrant.
And so the sort of the image of Justinian has come down to us. It's a very interesting character.
Yeah.
And his wife Theodora, who he made a joint empress.
Wasn't she a prostitute?
Well, that's right. Yeah, she was an actress stroke prostitute.
Which is a very flexible term in the ancient world. Not a very respectable one either.
No, they absolutely went hand in hand. Being an actor. Well, there's this idea that to pretend to be someone else is just morally wrong.
Yeah.
It's up there with prostituting your body or something. It's just, you shouldn't really do it. In fact, that we'll get into that about the factions, about the sort of the class element to it.
Yeah.
So the Nikkei writes about 5 years into Justinian's reign. We have to talk about the hippodrome and the circuses
and the political environment in Constantinople.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe we could start there.
Before we start, right. So as I understand it, Constantinople was founded in the 4th century by Constantine after winning the civil war that allowed him to become the emperor, reunite the empire. And so he moves the imperial capital to Constantinople because of its central location and strategic position on the Bosphorus. This is, 200 years later? So by now it's a very big city, probably like 1 million people living there, something like that. It's huge. It's remarkably well defended. It's the jewel of the empire. It's the most important city. It's superseded Rome at this point, especially as Rome fell to the Goths and the Vandals and whoever else. So, it's like the last imperial city. And it's the seat of a massive bureaucracy, and it's very sort of set in its ways, I guess, is the way to describe it. Like, you know, as I understood it, there was, you know, this deeply layered and hierarchical structure in which, like, things are all interconnected. And so you've got lots of, like you say, like ministers and eunuchs and stuff doing all these sorts of imperial functions that have all got a proper way of doing their proper place. And it's all, it reminds me of like the Chinese bureaucracy. You know, that's the sort of impression I got from it. But again, I'm no expert, so correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, a lot of that is right. The only thing I would say is that by the sort of early 500s AD, we're into a period of sort of more militaristic rule.
Right.
So, for example, Justinian came from almost nothing. And Theodora is, well, a prostitute, an actress rather. And so that annoyed a lot of the aristocracy, the existing aristocracy. So if we take, for example, the age of Caesar and Augustus and Tiberius, everything there is more, it's very oligarchic. The aristocracy is really important. If you weren't of a noble, blue-blooded family, you wouldn't get close. Mm. Whereas by the time of Justinian, well, his uncle, Justin, was a military usurper whose father was a shepherd. Mm. So Justinian's grandfather was a shepherd. So he came from nothing, basically.
Yeah. So you can see why the aristocrats who expected one of their own to be raised to the purple are kind of resentful about this.
Hugely, yeah. And a lot of all of that plays out. It's not really mentioned explicitly. One thing I was going to say about the sources is Procopius and his Secret History. But also we've got Edward Gibbon, the superb English historian, late 18th century. Late 17th century. Very early 19th century.
All right.
Late 18th century, early 19th century. And he. This is one of my favourite bits.
All right.
I've actually done a video for my channel about this, and I spoke to Apostolic Majesty, wasn't it, about the reign of Justinian as well. Hmm. So I happen to know it quite well. But this particular period, because I thought maybe this might be a good epoch, because the last few we've done, we've talked about a vast swathe of time, whereas this is really quite tight. We're talking about 5-6 days, a week's worth of events tops. So it's like really quite quite an intense story. We should talk about perhaps the chariot racing and the hippodrome.
The circuses aspect of the bread and circuses.
Yeah, yeah. One thing to mention is people will probably know of the Colosseum in Rome. That's different to the circus. Have you been to Rome before?
I have.
If you go outside the Colosseum a few hundred yards in one direction, there's just like this big open bit of grass. That was the circus. And so that is like a long, elongated bit of open ground, completely separate to the sort of a theatre or an amphitheatre. In Constantinople, they were much more interested in the circus, or the hippodrome, as they called it. They're more interested in that than sort of gladiatorial games, it seems.
And what did they do in the hippodrome?
Well, they raced chariots. So first and foremost, the history of it, there used to be just two factions, two colours, the whites and the reds. Some say it sort of might be to do with sort of mirroring the summer and winter. But anyway, by the age of Justinian, there were four factions. There were also the blues and the greens. And by the age of Justinian, it's the blues and the greens that are by far the most popular. But there's much more to it than simply being a fan of chariot racing.
Yeah.
These fan groups or these factions, it spills out into all sorts of socioeconomic aspects.
Religious. Yeah. Because we've got to remember that at the time, there are lots of Christian heresies going around and schisms and... is this the era of iconoclasm, or is that slightly afterwards?
There's some iconoclasm, but not exactly by this point. At this time, there's the Monophysites is one of the big ones. So the blue faction are Orthodox,
right?
And the Greens are sort of more Monophysite.
So heretics.
But it's not sort of in exactly the same vein as perhaps sort of if you think of a medieval Inquisition, say. No. It's not quite like that. You are sort of allowed your beliefs to some degree. It depends what you do and what you say with it. You're not sort of instantly, your soul isn't instantly damned.
Yeah, it's hard to,
it's a bit different.
It's hard to explain like medieval Christian heresies, because we call them heresies and that implies that they're in a distinct and definite category in which, like, you know, oh, right, okay, evil, you know, bad person. But it's not, because they're based on very fine distinctions. I can't remember what the Monophysite one was, but like the Arian heresy is, well, was Jesus a man or was he a god? And it's like, okay, well, I mean, who knows? You know, you don't know. No one knows. You know, who cares? You know, you both follow Jesus, don't you? You both agree to his teachings. Is that not enough? No, we need to know whether the wafer turns into the blood of Christ. Okay. And so they're very, very fine, like, distinctions. And to a non-Christian, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. You're all the same to a non-Christian. But anyway, so it's important to understand that the word heresy is probably over-egging it a lot, to be honest. Mm. You know? It feels a lot like, you know, watching communists talk online. Where like, well, I'm an anarcho-syndicalist. Well, I'm just a communist. And it's like, okay, but what's the difference? Mm. You know, you all want to collectivize property, don't you? So, you know, but anyway.
I think it's one of those things where it's when you claim that your position is infallible and you get dogmatic about it, then the tiniest thing matters.
Yeah.
You know, like all the Islamic schisms there have been. It's like, why do you care if
schisms?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Like, why do you care if Jesus was a god or merely sort of a divine man? Or what does it matter? Well, because you're talking about the unalterable truth.
That's true.
Divine exactly truth, right, so it does matter. To us, it's a bit, seems...
Well, it seems ridiculous.
Seems silly, doesn't it?
But yeah, anyway, yeah.
But
what are the class distinctions that you mentioned? You mentioned sort of like the socio-political classes.
So the Greens were a lot more thought of as sort of an aristocratic party.
Right.
That's why Theodora, actually, her family were originally Greens, but she's famously a Blue. Justinian and Theodora, famously Blues.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I'm aware that they support the Blues, but I wasn't aware that the Blues were like the working class pleb party.
A bit more. It's less that, rather more, if it makes sense, more that the Greens are aristocratic, not that the Blues are out and out sort of working class anything. It's just the Greens were...
But they're going to take on that kind of aspect.
Exactly.
If the Greens are the aristocrats, well, you're not with us, then you're one of them, you know.
Because she came from very, very humble upbringing. Yeah. Like her father was a bear tamer or something. So, yeah.
Something based like that.
Yeah. So she was, apparently the story was he used to be something like, he used to be a bear tamer for the Greens. And then at some point he died, leaving a few daughters. He'd expect the Green faction to sort of look after them, take them under their wing. But they didn't want to for whatever reason. They sort of threw them out. And so... Theodora went over to the Blue side, and from that point on, the whole rest of her adult life was sort of staunchly Blue.
Right, okay. But it's very interesting how it just sounds like Labour and Conservative, doesn't it? You know, that's what it sounds like to me. That's what I'm hearing when we describe it like this. You know, it's not necessarily that one party is all this or all that, but they've got these, you know, aspects to them that still come across all this time later, you know.
It's funny when you define yourself in opposition to something.
Yeah.
It's not what you actively think or like. It's just a reaction to something you hate.
Yeah.
That's not really a good thing, is it? Like, no, never kind of Trump sort of thing.
Orwell, in the book club you did, Orwell calls it a negative patriotism.
Right.
So it's not that you're pro something, you're just anti something. Mm. You know? It's like, I just hate that thing. And, you know, I think we all fall susceptible to it when we see, I don't know, Black Lives Matter or something. Just, no, I'm not that.
Yeah.
You know? But anyway,
Also, the Blues were sort of pro Justin and Justinian, pro monarchy, and the Greens were a bit more pro sort of oligarchy, maybe. Also, the religious aspect of it. Apparently, that hadn't been around for all that long. There was an emperor before Justin called Anastasius, where he apparently is only like a generation before this. Mm. He was the first one, Gibbon says, Procopius? I can't remember now. He was one that sort of introduced the religious aspect to it as well, with the Blues being Orthodox.
Right, okay.
So it just doesn't help. It's sort of like gets towards sort of a perfect storm of discontent.
Yeah.
You know, because you mentioned earlier that 30,000 people end up being massacred in this, and yet half of Constantinople is burnt down. The Hagia Sophia is burnt to the ground.
Oh, yeah, because
the Senate House is burnt to the ground.
So it shows you that there's deep underlying political conflict.
Yeah, there's loads more than just Chariot fans going on. There's a lot more going on than that.
And don't get me wrong, I'm aware that the Blues and the Greens, often you have small riots, like football hooligans, going off and doing this. But it seems it's a lot more embedded into regular society, as in the fact that you're a blue or green probably matters in your day-to-day life, not just when you're in the Hippodrome.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a few quotes in a bit, but he absolutely says that the whole of society is sort of under the thumb of these factions in some ways. Yeah. And it has been around for a long time as well. There's a quote I've got where I'll just quickly read one. So it goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Even Nero was a huge fan of chariot racing and dreamed of being a chariot racer. He'd like to have been a chariot racer. It just says, but the names of Caligula, Nero, Vitellius, Varus, Commodus, Caracalla, and Elagabalus, quite a lot of the bad ones there, were enrolled in the blue or green factions of the circus. They frequented their stables, applauded their favourites, chastised their antagonists, and deserved the esteem of the populace by the natural... by the natural or affected imitation of their manners. So even emperors idolize famous chariot racers.
And it's interesting how this isn't confined to just Constantinople then.
No.
Because these people often, most of them lived before Constantine. So this was just an empire-wide thing probably, right?
Yeah. They think that even in the Eastern Roman Empire, there were over 150 hippodromes around the place.
Blimey.
Of course, the one in Constantinople is the main one, sort of the big show.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all over the place. It's sort of the main sport, it seems.
Well, I mean, this goes back to the days of sort of Pericles, where they have chariot racing as well in the Olympic Games, don't they? Yeah, Alcibiades famously winning first, second and fourth or something with three chariots. So it's, this is an ancient world. It's like the, football of the ancient world, isn't it? Something that everyone gets in on, and there's a lot of glory for winning of it. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, there's Mycenaean pottery thousands of years before this showing chariot racing.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So it's huge by this point. It is sort of the main thing.
Mm.
In some of the early, really early Olympic games, some of the games in sort of the 600s BC, they introduced chariot racing and extended the Olympics to be extra days long. It's a really big thing.
Yeah.
And of course, the Hippodrome at Constantinople is sort of, as I mentioned, sort of like the big stage.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of more grand.
It's like Wembley Arena.
I got one quote here from Gibbon. He says that, quote, 10, 20, 40 chariots were allowed to start at the same instant. A crown of leaves was the reward of the victor, and his fame, with that of his family and country, was chanted in lyric strains more durable than monuments of brass and marble. But a senator or even a citizen conscious of his dignity would have blushed to expose his person or his horses in the circus of Rome.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.